kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode number 79. This is The Random Show Part 2 with me, Di Barnes.
And me, Doug Belshaw. Di, why is this The Random Show Part 2?
Because the links that we are going to discuss are randomly aggregated, so we're not just having a particular theme other than the fact that it might jump from place to place to place, but we'll try and bring some kind of synergy to it. I don't know.
I thought it worked quite well last time. I mean, it did go on a bit, almost 2 hours, but yeah, we're going to be a bit shorter this time, and you're heading off, aren't you? You're traveling the world.
I am, yes. So I'm it's the end of term on Friday. So, and I'm on Monday, I'm flying off to Mumbai and then over to Thailand, to Bangkok. So, the school are doing it. I'm going on a school trip to India in December, and I have to go and do a risk assessment and reconnaissance for that trip. And so the school are paying for me to fly out to India. All the accommodation and everything is free once I'm there. Yeah, so I'm just going to pay for a ticket over to Bangkok and see a couple of old friends, and both teachers, who, are working out there, and then go to India and check out where it is we're going to be building school buildings. I think we're going out to build, something like that. So I have to check source of materials, see, we sleep in these very impoverished conditions. So I have to go and sleep in them and see what they're like, whether we can lock doors, where the toilets are, what the mosquitoes are.
Oh, right, just to make sure it's going to be safe and things. Yeah. So every time we say we're going to keep this quite short, we end up making it the longest we ever have done. So just in case people haven't got 2 hours of their life to spare to get to the question which we're going to ask, which will turn into Tide 80, do you want to explain what we're going to do, maybe the question we're going to ask, and how Tide 80 is going to come into being?
Yes. So Tide 80 is going to be the second iteration or an iteration of when we tried using Anchor, the audio recording app, for different people to contribute towards a conversation. So we're going to try that again. Anchor has been updated. It's got some new features and things. So we'll see what they're like and whether they're useful. And we're going to center it around something that came out of episode number 77, which is the idea that getting learners to care about why they're there and what they're doing is the most important thing. So rather than arguing the hypotheticalness of that, we're going to ask people to contribute stories of that illustrate either them caring as a learner and what made them care, or indeed the learning that they were facilitating, leading, designing, whatever, how the learners cared, why the learners cared about what it is that they were doing.
Okay, so if you go, when this goes live, Tide episode 79, the link at the top of the show notes will be to anchor.fm, and you can download the app and you can comment and leave your feedback and your answers to the question, which is about how you personally have got learners to care about their learning, and potentially also got your colleagues and yourself to care about what you're doing rather than just showing up and grinding away.
Yeah, so it's not something that's based in the school. It's all to do with learning and just different experiences of learning. And I think people's personal anecdotes of why things have happened serve as, you know, it was in the evidence episode, wasn't it? It serves as sort of good evidence, and it inspires others to sort of try different things in the classroom because they've engaged people in what they're doing in different ways.
And I really enjoyed the conversation last time. I mean, one of the reasons we did it was because I was traveling, you're traveling this time, so some of the answers that you give will be recorded in India or in Bangkok or maybe when you're in England or wherever you're going to be, airport. And that's one of the really nice things, that you can just do little snippets. And I learned a lot and, you know, really enjoyed the feedback we got last time. Anchor has had over $2 million worth of investment from what we've read, I think, before we've gone live here. And so there's lots of new features in there, including the ability to clip audio from existing things that have been recorded, add applause in, different threads, download stuff. And from what I understand, they've removed the limitation on how much you can record at one time. So it was 2 minutes, I think, before. Yes. But to the flip side of that is they're not storing the audio you record forever. It's slightly ephemeral. So we're going to have to create the recording on Anchor and then archive it, I guess, as Tide episode 80.
Yeah, so hopefully what we should get is contributions from different people who want to participate, talking about things that really matter to them, that were really important to them as learners or as teachers, or whatever walk of life you're in. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily school, it's not necessarily education as such. We might be working in business or whatever, and you'd have these different sort of interesting things just to what you believe made the difference in a unit of work or in a lesson or a series of lessons or whatever.
Yep.
So it should be good.
Good, and with or without technology, all good.
Oh yes, completely.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So we know what you're going to do in the coming weeks. What have you been doing? Well, we're recording this on Tuesday night, and we last recorded on Thursday. So I guess what you've been doing at the weekend.
That's a fair point. I wrote reports, and so I think I've been doing that. I want to make a shout out for writing reports via voice. I don't know why it makes a big difference to me, but when I write more of my reports by speaking into my computer and it converts them into text, it feels different as a process to do. There's something about holding the child in mind whilst speaking that's different to typing. It's an odd thing. I'm not quite sure.
It's not to do with speed.
It's not to do with speed. I don't think it's particularly quicker. I take more care. The reports I've written, I really, really like.
Is the outcome of what you write, do you think, more conversational, less formal? Or?
I haven't really analysed it yet. I'm going to ask the children what they think about, or some of them, and what they think about the reports that I've written. And so I do funny things with reports, like I get the children to write their own, and they have to, their challenge is that I don't edit their report whatsoever because I agree with it and it's written so well that I will put it forward as my report, as it were, that kind of thing. So I'm interested in how useful they find that feedback. And
I think that's actually a good example of getting kids to care about their learning, because it kind of gives them some agency and makes them feel like things aren't being done to them.
Yes, I think so. That is something that's part of our relationship. Mm. I just wrote an email tonight to some of the boys in my boarding house about whatever. But as part of that email, I wrote that I'm not trying to encroach upon your relationship with whomever, because we're all responsible for our relationships with each other. And it's a real thing, I think, in education, is if whenever I'm doing my job well, I feel I'm taking responsibility for the relationship with each individual that I work with, which is exhausting, possibly, or difficult, and would lead me to an argument that the quality of a school is based on the number of pupils that you have to teach, as in one of the prime determinants.
Because you can't have as deep a relationship with so many children.
Yeah, you can't hold. So I've been, you know, I currently run at just less than 100 pupils at the moment, and I can pretty much hold all of those pupils in my mind and their work at any one point. You know, you could ask me about any one of them and I would be able to visually identify their work in my mind and what their progress is with my subject. And that's nearly, but not quite. I've worked with, you know, 300 and more pupils in the past. And it's just impossible, you know, the work all merges into one thing, and the faces all merge into one, the name, you know, you just lose it, except for, you know, the top 10, 20, 30, not just top as in ability, but top as in your mind. And
yeah, the ones who are cheeky, the ones who don't behave as well.
Yeah, all of that. And because you're drowning in it, it's really hard to bring any kind of integrity and quality to your relationship with them as individuals. So I would argue that it was worth scrutinizing how many pupils any one teacher has at one time within an academic year to see how well that they can do a good job, basically.
You know, we've talked in the past about John Hattie's work and about effect sizes and things. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the way that my understanding is, and I haven't read his research for a while, but my understanding is that the way that things are measured is to do with examination results. But what you're describing there isn't, I mean, one way of analyzing that would be, do kids get better test results if they are in smaller classes? And John Hattie's work would suggest Yes, but it's not as big as you would imagine. But then the relationship that you have with not only the child, but the child's parents, that kid and their friendship group, and, you know, you might not even teach some of those other boys. Like, it's a big deal, isn't it? Those relationships, which in your case, you've talked about students that you taught maybe 10 years ago that you're still in contact with.
Yeah, certainly. And I think every teacher has that to a certain extent. I think every teacher makes strong relationships with certain pupils that they teach. And I think that's part of the beauty of school, you know, is that pupils find different adults. You know, it's not just like one teacher is the one that everyone wants to know. You know, people make their choices because they're different personalities. And but I think the strength of having good, positive relationships with all of your pupils as far as is possible is something that is a pot that can only be so big, certainly for me. And I imagine for others as well. So therefore, I kind of thought it wouldn't be about class size. It wouldn't matter if you had big or small classes. It would be the number of pupils that you teach.
Yeah. And that would have an impact on how often you taught them, not just 50 minutes once a week or whatever. Yeah, interesting. Yeah,
completely. And also, if you look at the model of primary school, one of the commonalities of primary schools is that they have one main teacher. Mm-hmm. And then when you go to secondary school, that is the thing that changes. And so if you have one main teacher, then you have much fewer pupils or many fewer pupils to keep in your mind. And when you get to secondary school, all of a sudden that explodes to.
You see, that's why I'm quite a fan of middle schools. I haven't gone through them myself. Now my sons are one that it's a, you know, I did work in a school which was extremely low attainment. This was the school where there were some kids who couldn't even get the score to get on the, you know, on the CAT scores. They couldn't even get on the verbal ladder. They were below the minimum grade. Wow. And they created like a home base for that. Well, that's what middle school is like. You have your teacher who teaches most subjects, but then you go to specialist teachers for maths, English and science and music and PE. Yeah. So you kind of, it's a stage between like primary and secondary school. It's quite nice, I think.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it's a model that has some legs. And I started a middle school as well at Chantry, just where in the town that you live in and next door to the school.
Ben School.
Chantry Middle School. And back in the day. But I left after 1 year, unfortunately, because we moved to Middlesbrough. So I didn't experience that. And I went into 5 years of secondary school education on moving. Right. Okay.
So you've been doing that since Thursday. What have I been doing? I've been writing some stuff, send out the badge news newsletter. If you're interested in open badges, go to badge.news and get self-subscribing. But the best thing that I did was on Saturday afternoon. There's a museum in Newcastle called the Discovery Museum. My wife had signed us all up to giant cardboard making. And this was part of a program of events that included Minecraft, making electronics, doing all kinds of makey-makey kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And I was expecting to go along there and just help my own kids and maybe some other kids. But of course, you get in a room full of cardboard and you can make anything you want and you've got huge amounts of space. And you're almost pushing the kids out of the way to make stuff for you know, for yourself.
I can just envisage you right there, right now. I'm thinking back to your igloo time-lapse video when you made an igloo in your back garden.
Yeah, exactly. When I get, you know, the red mist descends. The equivalent of the red mist.
Red mist is a strong word. That's a positive thing.
The purple mist.
The purple mist, okay.
But what happened was they had all kinds of stuff. It was just the most amazing thing. And they had, you know, when shops shut down, they have like last day today, ending soon or whatever. Uh-huh. And it was on very stark yellow, black, everything like that. And so I just took some of those and made this kind of robot thing that went over the top of me. And it just said end time on it. Ben made a tank with he sawed off a bit of someone's walking stick when it was broken and put that as like the tank turret thing. It was fantastic. And then Grace and...
I'd be worried there a little. I thought Ben is going around sawing people's walking sticks. That's
and using hot glue. And oh, it was great. And
hot
glue guns and stuff. And then on the back of his, he put smelly end. And then Grace and Hannah, so my Grace, my six-year-old, and Hannah, my wife, made a castle with a working drawbridge, very primary school teacher-like.
Oh, very good, though. Nonetheless, I approve.
But we had such a good time. And Ben was the eldest there at 10, all the rest of them aged between kind of 4 and 9, I guess. Couple of hours and just, I haven't done that kind of thing where I've been focused on making my own thing because everyone else is happy doing theirs for ages.
Excellent.
Really good.
Sounds like a good day out.
Mm. And then just yesterday we did a think-a-thon. So, you know, I shared last week about the digital employability stuff?
Uh-huh.
So it turns out my colleagues think that's a pretty good idea and there's a bit of a goer. So you've seen the book proposal, I think, that I've shared. And yeah, we're going to put in a grant proposal as well.
Yeah.
And hilariously, and I'm going to publish this blog post, isn't quite ready on the We Are Open blog. But hilariously, the way that Brian chose to represent some of the stuff we talked about yesterday was as the unwritten books of Dr. Belshaw, as if it was a series of 8 books, and each of them, he's done it really cleverly. Each of them was almost like a lens of the very rambling kind of, we zoomed in, went down rabbit holes, then zoomed out and looked at the landscape. So just very quickly, these 8 books, which are kind of lenses on digital employability, were The Web of Reputation, HR, as in human resources, recruitment is broken. Pay Attention, How to Make Your Own Mistakes and Not Someone Else's. Desired New World, Invent and Reinvent, Digital Skills Sandwich, and Hack Your Life.
Okay.
So by the time we publish this podcast, that will be published, so I'll stick the link in for you and for anyone else who might be interested in that. It's kind of one of those situations where you're trying to find out where the edges of the thing is, where the edges are,
yeah.
And you're trying to make it, you're trying to keep on telling the story to yourself and to others until it makes sense, because you know that you're onto something.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That's good. That's absolutely right. It's something that I was thinking about today, actually, is that so having written my reports, actually, some of them are really, really well written, and sometimes I write really, really well.
Mm.
But not all of the time, and I'm very conscious of what are the variables or the elements that are in place when I write well, and they're not in place when I don't. So I'm trying to look at the common ground between times that I feel like I've written things well and I'm in it.
Do you mean in terms of times of day that you're composing them, or in terms of
so I think about it as in when I feel my mind is wrapped well enough around a topic, I'm able to write about it.
Right.
So when I feel I've explored it in different ways, I've left it, I've come back to it, and it's what you're saying is kind of, you go into the detail and you come back out to the landscape and you're looking at where the edges are and what the purpose of the writing is and what the purpose of why you're writing.
No, I think that's really important, and I think that we underplay that kind of intuition sometimes.
Mm.
In very structured environments. I was saying, I think I've said this on this podcast to you before, and I've certainly said it to you, Di, but I was talking to my wife the other day about, I was just reminding myself of that film, I Capture the Castle, where the kind of slightly eccentric writer puts up stuff around the walls and lets it stew for a while. And I will always do that now. Like this blog post I've written, it's not quite right, so I'm leaving it overnight and I'll come back to it. And as soon as I get to it, I'll know what to write, even though I don't know what to write now. And then just a reminder of when I was on the Mozilla Open Badges team and we were talking about productivity and the way that we work and the best times of working and stuff. And I remember Carla Casilli saying that she's got a list of things that she needs to do and she works on the thing which she feels most strongly about at any given time or most inspired to do, you know, as long as there's not like a pressing deadline. And I remember that very simple thing being a revelation, having only ever worked in, you know, schools and universities before that.
Yeah, where you have to work on the thing that's next on your plate and that's expected from you from somewhere.
Yeah, someone's telling you what's important, whereas you're deciding what's important. And over the last couple of years, it's been interesting. And it's a hard explaining that to somebody, you know, people who only have ever worked in education and stuff, or, you know, have only worked in offices and things, that, you know, you work on the thing that you're feeling. Like, it's much, it feels a bit, I don't know, a bit privileged, but also like a bit, oh, well, how do you get the real work done? You know, if you just work on the candy floss all the time, but it's not quite like that.
No, it's not quite like that. Because the point is that you change in your texture through the days and the within a day and over the days, and you like doing different things at different times.
Yeah.
And I always like trying to get to some kind of truth. And I think when I don't like things and I don't write well is where I feel that I'm detached. I don't really know what the truth is. I'm just kind of
trying. And you're having to force it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, this, I mean, I didn't intend for this to be a link to that, but the other thing I've done yesterday, I'm writing this audiobook on productivity, as you know. Have I given you a link to this, as in, like, to download it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, chapter 4. So, I'm writing it, like I have with all my ebooks and stuff, using this open beta process where, you know, it starts off as £1 and it gets more expensive as I add more stuff up to a maximum value. And then I edit it and re-record it and stuff. Anyway, I've done the first 3 chapters, and I finished that in January around the 3 pillars of productivity, you know, exercise, nutrition, and sleep. And then chapter 4 is about time and how we all feel like we haven't got enough time in the day, and how you can, some strategies you can get around that. So that's now available. I'll put the link in there if anyone's interested.
Excellent.
Good, but let's crack on. There's a slightly controversial article there's a really interesting blog, actually, I came across called Truth Hawk, and I've stuck the link in here, and the title is "We Are Treating Young Boys Like Animals."
This is, so, right, I read this in the title, and I'm not keen straight away. So I've read the article earlier this evening, and I think this sort of thing, so I'm really interested in institutionalized prejudice, like racism, misogyny, etc. And this is like that. It's about institutionalized trends, as it were, or the way that we're treating an entire gender through school and the way the school is structured. But still, lots of it doesn't sit easy with me. I want to push back on quite a few points.
Well, let me just say first, on what you've just said there, you said last week, because I was just listening back to that episode, as I always do, you said, and I absolutely agree with this, that people, ourselves included, say, hey, you know, I'm not sexist, I'm not racist, I'm not homophobic, yet we have all of these unconscious biases because, hey, I was raised in a monoculture, and I find myself tripping up on over my own prejudice quite often. And I've certainly been in the situations where I've seen boys just being boys as getting in the way of my lessons. Yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
And this is talking about America, USA, but some of the statistics are pretty shocking.
Go on then, pick me some statistics that you think are shocking out of this article. So basically the article is saying that children are inconvenient to schools and young boys are inconvenient above all. Mm. And it says that boys are just girls who are getting it wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to belabor the point about there being not enough male teachers for boys under the age of 13. I wouldn't want to belabor that point because, you know, it's fraught territory. But I think the thing which is difficult to argue is the number of boys who are referred as having learning difficulties.
Where's that?
So it talks about because young boys don't fit the system, which is ostensibly humanist, they are treated like animals. The school system does this by drugging, caging, and punishing. So some of the punishing bit, it says boys are punished for being unsuited to the modern classroom. 80%, and it has a link to evidence for this, 80% of all special ed referrals are for boys, 71%, and again it has a link to evidence for this, 71% of all school suspensions are for boys. And if you take those figures, it's hard not to come to the conclusion that school is more suited for females.
I think that's a fair point. So when I read the 71%, I thought, okay, out of every 10 children in school, out of 10 suspensions from a school, so a suspension is a fixed term exclusion, seven of those suspensions will be boys and three will be girls.
Yeah.
So, that didn't really surprise me.
No, it's not surprising, but if that was the other way around, we'd think there was a huge problem.
We would, because it would be against our expectations and stereotypes of what we live in.
Yeah, if it was 80% of referrals or 71% of school suspensions are BAME, you know, Black, Asian, Middle East, and like we'd think that was a problem. So there's.
I want to put, I think for some reason in my mind there's a big difference between 8 out of 10 of all special ed referrals being boys. And that's referrals, not actually people in special education. It's somehow much bigger than 7 out of 10 to me. Rather suspensions, I don't know. It's a bit weird. So maybe my own prejudice here are having a little bit of a stir, and I'm trying to work out what I really think about this data. But what's interesting, so let's just have a look at how school systems are forms of ritual and order, it says, that don't lend themselves to boys. So it gives 8 bullet points that are quick to read. So I'll just read through them.
Okay.
Book learning over experiential learning. Enforced social structure over, oh my God, I've just put my computer to sleep. Can you still hear me?
Yeah. Enforced social structure over natural social structure.
Being quiet over interrupting.
Artificial peace over spontaneous fighting.
Order over play.
Sitting inside over being outside.
Safety over danger.
And conformity over self-expression.
So I thought it's quite interesting, isn't it? How, I mean, schools weren't designed as such. Do you know what I mean? They're kind of an accident, really, or, you know, they're like byproducts of scarce resources. And it's what people wanted back in the day. You know, at some point people said, we must get people educated, and getting education for everybody was like a huge, huge deal. You know, it's a big win.
My son today, I mean, it's one of those bizarre coincidences where there's a museum, which you'll know, called Beamish in County Durham, which is, so the buildings, they have actors who play the roles of people, and it's kind of kept at being late Victorian or early 20th century kind of England. And one of the funniest things is to go into the schools, because it's, you know, Victorian schoolhouse. And my son went in there today. He's been in there before. He knows the routine. And they were practicing handwriting. And obviously they've got left-handers in their class. And the left-handers had their left hands tied behind their back because they had to use their right hand. And the reason for that was because if you're left-handed and you're sitting next to someone right-handed, you'll knock them. And everyone should have to write with their right hand because it's just a better thing to do. And that's the conformity element. And it's easy to think, well, we don't really do that these days. But of course we do. We ring bells to get children to move across the school in line and like all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, isn't it? It's very odd that Ben has sat in a classroom that I sat in as a child. on a school trip or the same school trip kind of thing. There we go. So I think it's interesting. So they do some identification of that schools repress this at every turn. This is the idea of that the boys like high activity, play, outdoor explanation, constant questioning, questioning, initiative taking, fighting, aggression, self-expression, experience, and constant motion, and that schools repress this and the results are disastrous is what they're arguing. And because they score worse in tests, they get lower grades, are disciplined more frequently, and are developmentally stunted, which I think is a really interesting thing when you look at, when you start looking at institutionalized misogyny and sexism and where that all kind of stems from, and that it, you know, the home is often blamed for that, and the different roles of male and female parents, and the model that you present to your children as you grow, and but actually schools might be responsible for quite a lot of this too. And I certainly have, as we've discussed it before, my childhood is full of blue skies and rain and streams and swings and trees and bikes and balls and people and climbing and, you know, running around and doing all that sort of thing, as well as watching loads of telly. It was by no means a good, healthy childhood. It just was the childhood that I had, but I did all of those things all of the time. So so certainly I think that, and I remember sitting in classrooms just like not understanding how my body felt and not understanding why I couldn't change how my body felt, and just staring at clocks waiting for them to tick to the moment I get out of that room.
Yeah, indeed. And it's interesting because I'm certainly, I hate the kind of teacher blaming that goes on. But then the other side is that certainly in my little filter bubble, my kind of left-wing progressive educator teacher bubble, we're often presented with amazing schools who are doing fantastic stuff and mixing things up. But the thing to remember is most schools aren't like that. And most schools, like you've just said, you know, if I walked into my son's school, as I have done a few times, it feels exactly the same as when I went to school, except with a couple of iPads in.
Which makes all the difference.
And that, you know, I have to say, at the same time as I think, oh my goodness, it is quite comforting because we've got that kind of shared common experience.
Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it? I always find it absolutely fascinating when you get two people of the same age. I guess it's because I'm getting older, and you start talking about, or you're reading articles about the things of your time, like, you know, if you were a teenager in the 80s, you have a certain set of music which you just can't avoid loving now because it was around when you were young.
Yeah.
Even though you didn't like it at the time, possibly with quite a passion. I that's the sort of thing that changes, I guess, for every generation, sort of. And but there are certain things, as you say, that are the same, is that when you sit in a classroom as a child, at the end of the day, what is going on in there quite often is exactly the same as what happened for me.
And I think the difference is I can remember having more playtime than my son has.
I know. I worked in a school, a really tough school in called Hurlingham and Chelsea in Fulham. And Fulham is an interesting borough, Hammersmith and Fulham is, because it's long and thin, and the north of the borough, or the south, I think it's the north of the borough, is the Hammersmith end, and it's really well looked after by the local authority, and the south end by the river is not so much. Oh no, it's all by the river, it runs along the river, I think. I don't know. But it was, anyway, in this school, everyone used to go home at like 2:30 or something, because they just would, because they couldn't control the pupils. I was one of them, couldn't control the pupils. And they would just be, so the idea was, let's just squeeze transition time and time where the children got to make choices, which obviously is time out of lessons. And I'm sure that's not the case in everybody's classrooms, but do you know what I mean? That was the statistics. But actually, also, the school was built for 500, and we had 850 enroll.
Well, that's pretty common, isn't it? Especially these days.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, that's what's.
There's an interesting study that's linked to in this post on Truth Hawk. It says, consider this Finnish study. The results show that for 6 to 8 year olds, the less time spent being physically active and the more time being spent being sedentary, the worst performance was on reading and arithmetic tests. And if you click through, and this is only one study, but it's in Finland, and you know they're known for, you know, being awesome. It talks about moderate to vigorous physical activity and sedentary time, and they then they measure that, and they measure reading and arithmetic skills, and it's 89 boys and 69 girls, and they say the conclusions: lower levels of physical activity and higher levels of sedentary time, and particularly their combination, were related to poorer reading skills in boys. But interestingly, in girls, higher levels of sedentary time were related to better arithmetic skills.
That's really interesting, isn't it? It'd be really... So this is where the thing I said earlier on is a psychologist, Michael Thompson, says in his quoted saying, girl behavior is the gold standard in schools. Boys are treated like defective girls.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And that's an interesting thing.
Mm. And, yeah, I mean, it's difficult for us as privileged white males to sit here and talk about this, but there is definitely something here about the majority of boys for the majority of time will be taught by women who have never been young boys. Yeah?
Yes. So in America, just to run the stats, 2.3% of pre-kindergarten and kindergarten teachers are male, 18.3% of elementary and middle school teachers are male, and 42% of high school teachers are male. So women dominate this profession in this country across the board.
Yep. And it's no, like, for all the women listening to this, this isn't us trying to, you know, say, oh, this is just a evil feminist plot. Not at all, but it's more of like a thinking about the system in which things are and wondering what the outputs will be. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd argue it's knack all to do with the gender of teachers to a degree. And it's more about the systems. It's more about, I don't think it would matter whether it's a woman or a man that is in charge or whatever. When boys were given more ability to run around and to, it's like those exercises that some schools have run on revision where they do it with a whole year group in the gym. And they sit on a big rack of benching at the side, do 10 minutes work, and then do 10 minutes basketball drills.
So a local school here does that, yeah, definitely.
Because
there is the competitive element as well. I mean, I have wondered sometimes about, you know, Ben is extremely competitive. And, you know, if what one way of motivating him in learning, and this isn't true for all boys, I know that, would be, you know, if you put a leaderboard up, he wants to be at the top of that leaderboard.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. But I'd say, and it is a really relevant thing. I remember that both of my stepsons knew who they were competing against in the year, and my daughter actually knew who they were competing against academically. They didn't need to beat them. They just knew that they were competing against them.
Yeah.
But I would also argue that certainly a characteristic in myself is because I'm the middle of three boys in my family, I have a weird relationship to competition, whereas if I see competition as getting intense, I find it really easy to put down and not actually bother with.
Right.
So then I'm aware in myself that I will create an illusion that I'm doing that in a kind of grown up way. But that's actually what I'm really doing is saying, I'm never going to win here. So I'm just not going to try.
I'm not going to even compete. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that is what the system is. What this article is identifying within school systems possibly is quite a lot of boys are going to say, well, I'm not going to be the best, therefore I'm not going to bother.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, you know, there's lots of links in this article. So if you're listening to this and you're nodding your head, or you're listening to this and you're violently disagreeing, either way, read the article, follow the links, think about your own experience, and maybe weave it into the answer to the questions that you give on Anchor about, you know, caring, thinking about differentiation, thinking about personalized learning, thinking about how you do ensure that, you know, boys can succeed, you know, as well as girls, and as well as those who don't define themselves by gender. So
Okay. Last line of this article, just to finish that, is, by the way, if you're in the United States or United Kingdom, you may not know that homeschooling is illegal in dozens of developed countries. Count your freedoms.
Mm. It's actually linked to a Wikipedia list of places in which homeschooling is allowed and not allowed.
Wow, yeah.
Mm. Interestingly, it differs within Canada. That's interesting.
Within the country, there are different.
Yeah. Places. So whether there's regulations or whether you have to have a permit, some places it's unclear. Some places it's illegal. So, you know, in Costa Rica, there's just no rules. In Cuba, it's illegal. Just picking somewhere. It's been legal in Taiwan since 2011. Really interesting list, and you wonder what's caused this. Even within the EU, you know, some places it's legal, illegal, conditions, permits, all that kind of stuff. Really, yeah, it'd be interesting to write the history of that and why that's been the case.
Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Kazakhstan, all illegal.
Mm.
South Korea, prohibited by law. Turkey, illegal. Albania, illegal. Andorra, Belarus.
And it's interesting the way that it's stated in terms of the United Kingdom. It says homeschooling is legal as an alternative to the mandatory state school system. And of course, there's been different times in throughout the politics of the last 25 years, I'd say, when it's been threatened that there's going to be a crackdown on homeschoolers, hasn't there?
Yes, there has. Certainly quite. However, I'd say that there is a commonality between these countries, and please shoot me if I'm wrong, but they're all developed countries, but in some way developing. All of these countries have a certain possibility that children might be used to work and earn money if kept at home. Right. Looking at, you know, this sort of, so they're, you know, I don't know if these are all developed countries. I don't think they are, no. So, but in the article, it did say that developed countries.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, the insinuation at the end of the Truth Hawk thing is basically saying, hey, school isn't great for boys, so if you can, you should homeschool, and you should count your blessings that you can actually do that.
Exactly, because it's quite often that you can't.
Hmm. But then that there's so much potential privilege behind that in terms of being able to organize your life so that you can do that. It's whole kind of rabbit warren of tunnels to go down.
Mm. For another day.
Mm.
So,
well, instead of kind of focusing in on a slightly negative article, let's go for something a bit lighter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So something which I shared on Twitter this morning after reading at the weekend was sorry for the delayed response in the New Yorker. You saw this, didn't you?
I did. I thought this was absolutely great. Really enjoyed it because it's just hilarious.
So it's a series of short responses to hypothetical emails, and the person is replying at some point after they should. Have you got a favorite?
Several. Sorry for the delay. I put off answering your email until I had an even more tedious task that I wanted to avoid. Thanks. It's just plain.
I've received quite a lot like this one here. Oof, I really didn't mean to take 12 days to respond to your email. Does it ever feel like time is passing way too fast and you never have enough hours in the day to accomplish anything? Like the sands of time have eroded the midpoint of the hourglass and it's all just freely flowing through now? Anyway, to answer your question, yes, I can do 3 o'clock.
Yes, I've had many like that.
Like, the reason I like that response, that kind of response, is because they're not just saying, oh, yeah, sorry, I'm late, here's 3 o'clock. They're trying to explain that I'm a human being, I make mistakes, like, whatever. But
that's it. Or indeed not. This is superb. I've done this, I have to say. Oh, my God, so sorry. I'm finally responding to this email that I fully intended to ignore forever because I realized that I need to ask you for a favor, and I don't want to be holding an email grudge against me. I've done that. I thought, oh God, I can't ask them to do that until I've actually responded to that thing that they asked me to do 6 months.
Yeah, yeah. My absolute favorite one on this list, I have to say, which is very specific to, you know, understanding like the how email looks is this one. Yikes, the little Gmail preview text made your email seem like a regular great thanks email I didn't need to open. But now I see you asked a question after the great thanks. I think we can agree that was a stupid thing for you to do, so I don't even feel bad. I assume you found someone else to answer your question by now, but if not, Laura CC should be able to help.
That is super.
Class.
And I think the reason I like them is because whether you've done these or not, you kind of recognize yourself in them, or you see your own thought processes in them, or your own reactions to things.
Yeah, exactly. And I live in the world of email, but you must do even more so in the context you're in.
We get great emails. So I have, with former colleagues, I have an email thread that we still send to each other. And when a peachy email comes through to one of us in our different schools around the world, we send it to the email group.
Really?
Just to entertain each other. And it's really different seeing the different types of emails that are sent in different types of schools, different countries and things like that.
Yeah.
And you obviously get to win when you send your own email that you have sent to email group, because you know you've been such an ass, or it's just like funny or whatever. That's
talking about messaging people, there was a great XKCD cartoon last week, and for those who don't know XKCD, it described itself as a web comic of romance, sarcasm, math and language. And they were the ones who've created this book that I gave my dad for Christmas, trying to explain literally rocket science in words that a five-year-old would understand. But this particular one is about chat systems. Did you see this?
I did see this. I thought this was superb. Yeah, I do recommend, if you're listening, go and have a look at this, because what we can say,
there's just overlapping circles, some of which are bigger than others and include more people who are standing on this picture. And the kind of... the way it's described is, I have a hard time keeping track of which contacts use which chat systems. So some of them on here are what? Email, SMS, Slack, Hangouts, iMessage, Facebook Messenger, Skype, ICQ, Twitter DM, the wall in the bathroom, BBM, the chat tab in an old Google Doc.
I love that. And but the thing I like about it is it doesn't even cover them all. So you have Facebook Messenger, Facebook Wall, Twitter DM, Twitter Open, do you know what I mean? Instagram DM, Instagram, you know, comment on somebody's post, blah, blah, blah. I always find it funny when you see, like, on Instagram, people start having a conversation on a public thread. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And really get a room, you know? But it's absolutely right. So whenever I want to contact someone, it's interesting how your communications are driven. So there's a lot of group chats these days, you know what I mean, of different sorts, and which this doesn't even really even begin to open either, the idea of the group chat, you know.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Which app shall I use? I want to use this one. And really, you just want one app to rule them all, and obviously that's never going to happen.
But do you find that you, let's say, let's just ignore the kind of group chat thing, but if you were just communicating with one person, would you say that you end up defaulting to one of them, or are there some people who you use kind of just a range of stuff depending on?
I don't mind being a bit of a whore kind of thing, spreading myself around. Do you know what I mean?
Chat whore.
Yeah, or an app one, certainly. And so I don't mind, I quite like thinking, like, oh, I want you to message Doug. Which app shall I use? And there are, I think, three that I would choose one of three that I was going to message you. Mm. And it's different with different people. And then some people I know, this is this app I communicate with these people on. Do you know what I mean? And it's just one app for them. But so it's interesting. And then when you try and go out of an app, that's what I find interesting, sort of social dynamic behavior. So if I was to message you on another app, it probably wouldn't be a big deal. But if I were to do that to other people, it's like, well, you don't normally talk to me here. And you get a reply back on the usual app that they use. It's quite funny. Well, they actually ask you, do you mind if we use WhatsApp?
No, exactly. Yeah. And I've had this conversation, like I think it was my mother last year said, hey, your sister's using WhatsApp. Why don't we all just use that? And I was like, over my dead body. Like, there's no way that's going to happen. And I mentioned last week I've got them on Telegram and stuff. But it can be, unless you're contacting people, like, every day or every week, it is sometimes difficult to remember who likes what.
No, that's absolutely right. And it's quite interesting because it's also sort of representative of real life, isn't it? It's like you only see people in certain places, generally speaking. So usually we would see each other at a conference, probably we'd expect to see each other in that environment. I wouldn't expect to see you in the common room bar just down the road, kind of thing. You know, different. I see certain people like that, and so psychologically you contextualize a relationship, a person.
You associate them with a particular interface, maybe.
Yeah, and so you're just doing the same, but online. So I don't think it feels unnatural. But to look at this XKCD cartoon image, it just makes you see how daft it all is.
No, it is. And just as on a practical note, this is the reason why I always will take the lead when I'm, and I will send the calendar invite when I'm arranging to meet somebody, because I want to use the platform that I want to use and not the platform that they happen to want to choose on whatever day of the week it is.
So whereas they think you're being really efficient and proactive, actually what you're being is efficient and proactive on your own terms.
Yeah, being a little dictator. And, you know, I try and push people towards open stuff. And, you know, the thing that I use, and there are people listening to this who have experienced this, I will say in a calendar invite, preferred, you know, appear.in/DJ Belshaw, backup Skype, and then I have my, you know, username. Because then you're saying, you know, I can accommodate you if you want to use Microsoft proprietary crappy tool, which we happen to be using to record this podcast. But like, I prefer using this particular tool. And for some people, it's the first time they've used it and then they find it good or whatever. But yeah, it's good to try and use those as opportunities to not only get your own way, but to nudge people towards things that you know are actually better solutions.
Now, when I started using Signal, and it replaces the messaging app on my phone, the text messaging app, and that's kind of cool. So and it's interesting to note that voice and text has now started to go over Wi-Fi, sort of thing. So the only thing you're really using although it's all become the same thing, I guess, but all you're really using your mobile phone for is to access the internet, is your data, essentially.
I think it's great. And the trouble is, for you people like you and me, and for people who are looking at this chat system's overlapping circles and thinking that it pretty much represents their life, for people like us, you know, the Signal app replacing your messaging app and your phone app, because you can use it as your phone app, just isn't conceptually difficult. But, you know, I mentioned about my parents and my wife as well liking Telegram more than other things like Signal. It's not compartmentalized enough. It's kind of just a bit going in. It's seeping into everything if that happens. See what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But I like that. I like the fact that it takes certain things. You mean I'm going to use this as like as a communications tool app, which you kind of for some reason see your phone and your text messaging is not. Do you know what I mean? They're kind of external. It's kind of like the old school proper way to do things.
Yeah.
When actually Signal doesn't replace your phone app. It just replaces, but you can use it to replace your phone app.
Well, Signal's doing nothing different than iMessage.
Yeah, I don't use that. So.
Well, you know, as you know, iMessage has the blue bubbles and the green bubbles, and it's blue if it goes over iMessage and green if it goes over SMS.
That's right.
And no one seems to have a problem with that. Yet with Signal, all of a sudden, it's really confusing.
I remember having massive problems with iMessage. So when you started talking to someone in iMessage and then you changed off iOS, you had to go and find yourself an Apple account somewhere and log into an Apple account, or probably on the phone, and disconnect.
Oh, no, I had that problem too when I switched from iPhone to Android. It's horrendous.
Yeah. I don't know if it's still the same, but wow. Anyway, very good.
The last thing I would say on that is that some of these things, including Snapchat, including Telegram and Signal, if you choose to have self-destructing messages, you almost need to be able to refer back to a decision point sometimes. So before we hit record on here, we were talking about social bookmarking tools and how sometimes it's difficult to go back and find things because we're not sure where we've saved them. And it's a bit like that when it comes to, didn't we decide we're going to do that thing? And then you've got no evidence that you decided to do that thing other than a vague memory, but you're not really sure whether you did do that or not. And so having a, you know, I often talk about canonical URLs for projects, almost like a default place in which you're going to communicate. And if it is an ephemeral chat thing, moving that decision point and putting it somewhere that you can access later on. I know that seems extremely formal, but it can be handy too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's that. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Is, I mean, I argue a lot of that about my work is what is formal and what isn't. You know, what do I do that is tied into strategy plans and do this, that, and the other, or is it listed somewhere? And what do I do that is me working off the cuff, as it were, ad hoc?
Cool.
That's interesting.
Tell you what we should do next. And it depends how long and how short we want to keep this particular episode, given that we're going to ask people to contribute for Tide 80. But there's a link here which I think could have been written better, but it was interesting, and it was surfaced on Hacker News, that kind of aggregator of tech-related stuff. And the title is, I Automated My Friends and Nobody Could Tell the Difference.
I've not seen this. Is it good?
Well, it doesn't quite live up to the title.
Oh, okay.
So
it's quite interesting.
So what they do is they create a bot in Slack. So Slack being a messaging app for teams that, you know, you and I are on for the We Are Open one, and other people listening to this might be on that one or other ones. And you can create bots so they can automatically do things. So in our one, in some of the channels, we've got things like, if someone updates a Trello card, that status is updated with the Trello bot in a particular channel. Or in the one that I used to use with my wife, if I add a calendar item, that gets added in the thing in Slack, and it's just automated. Mm-hmm. So what this person did was automate some of his colleagues. And by automate, he means like share things, the kind of things that person would usually share. So it starts off pretty tame, by a guy called David, and he tends to share some of the best articles he comes across. But this guy went and found the kinds of places that David finds his links, and then auto-tweets him as David bot some of those things. And people responded to him as if it was David and not David bot, if you see what I mean, as if he was a human being.
Yeah.
So he went a stage further. So one of the things that Slack is used for in Teams is when there's going to be a meeting saying, hey, we're having a call now. So on a Monday morning, our co-op has a call, and it's usually me who says, like, here's the agenda. We're meeting here. Don't forget, whatever. And they can be automated, obviously. And so he took Cassia, who is his colleague, and to start off with, he just had an at channel kind of message, which notifies everyone in the channel and just says, call now. And then change the bot to say, get ready for the call. It's in 2 minutes in Sherwood, which must be the name of the room. And just that kind of added a bit of humanity to the bot, which you can randomize as well, kind of added a bit of power and clout to it, even though it's the bot of the person rather than the person themselves. And just seeing how the person responds. So he's saying that nobody noticed, but I'm not sure they didn't notice. I just think that people respond in certain socially conditioned ways and don't know how to respond to bots, especially ones that have the avatar of the person themselves on it.
Yes, because we naturally scan a message to recognize it as human, and the things that we would do, one of those would be a profile picture, the other would be the kind of language that they're using, and the other would be the expectation of the message to be sent, to receive the message, and then so a lot of people wouldn't know to pay attention to the word bot on the end, I guess.
No, exactly. And of course you can do this on Twitter as well. So there's a guy who I follow, and I thought it was really nice that every morning he would say, morning all, And then I realized it was exactly the same time. Then I realized that he was automating that. And so sometimes I'd respond to his morning orders like, hey, how are you doing? Whatever. And then realized he wasn't actually online at that time.
Yes. And therefore, there was no point talking to him. It's going to be interesting because it's going to be more and more of this sort of thing, isn't it? Being able to distinguish on a computer between what is a person and what is not.
Yes. Definitely.
And therefore requires a response, possibly, and what does not.
I just thought that was quite interesting. Talking about kind of bots and that kind of thing, I don't know if you saw that DeepMind, which is that Google-owned artificial intelligence, machine learning kind of thing, they've been talking to the National Grid, i.e. the UK's national energy supply, about how they can reduce UK energy use by 10% after having done it to Google's server farms and reduced energy consumption by 15%.
All right, okay. This is interesting, isn't it? This is so what was this? This is a similar article to the guy from Tesla, Elon Musk, whatever he's called, saying to somewhere, I can't remember where it was to, that he could solve all of their power outage problems that they were experiencing. And he could get it built within 100 days or a month or something. Right. And he said, if I don't get it done within a month, and this was a conversation on Twitter, if I don't get it done within a month, you can have whatever you build for free.
Right.
And so they said, okay, no problem. and he went to do it because, but this is an example of how these big tech corps are taking over the world as well.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because they have the power and knowledge to the powers and the ability and knowledge to implement solutions that governments, big organizations like the National Grid, expert organizations, they're Google's in this case DeepMind, but Google.
Well, they've got the reputation that goes, with the stuff they've already done before.
Yeah.
But they're also not necessarily having to take into account the politics, we tried that before and it didn't work. They can be seen as a new broom, which always helps.
Yes, completely.
I tell you what makes me laugh about this post. So I don't know if you played this game, Theme Park, back in the day. But it says, Demis Hassabis, co-founder and CEO of DeepMind, brackets, and lead programmer on Peter Molyneux's Theme Park, under brackets, hopes that the UK... And I'm like, wow, that's a bit of a random aside.
But it talks to you, and it talks to anyone who's familiar with Theme Park, which was a big piece of software back in the day.
It does.
Super.
Anyway, I thought that was interesting, and thinking about this is a potentially great use of AI, and as you can see from the UK National Grid control room, of which there are six pictures in there, it's already a pretty complex thing. And we might think, oh my goodness, then wouldn't that mean that the Chinese could take it over and crush all of our systems? Well, the Chinese own quite a lot of our infrastructure already. And, there's systems which are possibly more susceptible to that than DeepMind. Although having said that, DeepMind's been in a bit of trouble this week about NHS data, haven't they?
Have they? I've not seen that, tell me.
Basically, we talked about this a couple of years ago when there was the care data thing, and I tried every way possible to opt out of it. And I don't know, and even in the end, I don't know if I did manage to opt out of it because it was so overwhelmingly complex. And the NHS London hospitals, they basically gave DeepMind data and didn't follow the Data Protection Act. And I think some of it got leaked and yeah.
Now, this is really interesting. So we talked about the NHS system before. My brother worked for Accenture for many years, and they gave up £127 million worth of expected payment from the NHS for the system that they were building to deal with medical data nationwide in all the different medical agencies. And they gave it up because they realized they were never going to be successful and it was only going to damage their reputation on a larger scale than £127 million worth of business.
Wow.
So they wiped it and moved on.
Mm. Well, just quickly Googling this, so I'm not being hand wavy. There's an article in the Register, which I'll just stick a link into here.
Yeah, I've got one
quickly. And it says Google's DeepMind and the Royal Free London NHS deal to use patient data without explicit consent was inexcusable, an academic paper has concluded in a damning report today. In 2016, DeepMind announced its first major health project, a collaboration with the Royal Free London NHS Foundation Trust, a large UK hospital organisation, to assist in the management of acute kidney injury. And secretive deals, specious claims, the paper's called Google DeepMind and Healthcare in the Age of Algorithms, and you know, giving algorithms control over who gets treatment, who doesn't, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's an interesting quote here they wrote. I'm not sure who they are, possibly DeepMind. No. Why DeepMind, an artificial intelligence company wholly owned by data mining and advertising giant Google, was a good choice to build an app that functions primarily as a data integrating user interface, has never been adequately explained by either DeepMind or Royal Free Hospital.
Hmm. Well, the same could be said of using G Suite for education, but hey, nobody's doing that analysis.
Well, no, I think it's exactly right. People are looking at that. They are looking, you know, there's guarantees when you sign up for G Suite for education that the data is not being used to target advertising, etc.
But did you see Bill Fitzgerald's post on that? I think we did talk about it in a previous episode. He talks about how he doesn't think there's been deliberate obfuscation. He just feels like it's a way that Google's policies have grown. But the guarantee that the data, student data, won't be used in advertising only applies to Google's G Suite core products, of which some of those which are used in G Suite for education aren't core products.
I'm not sure where the lines lie. So I know that as a G Suite administrator, I know that signing up for Google Maps, for example, is that you have to have written parental consent unless the individual is over 18 and things like that. So there are certain apps that you can't turn on because of that. But there's a lot of third party stuff that that doesn't require that.
I guess what I'm saying is that you're very conscientious about these things, and if you don't know, then most people don't know.
That's a fair point.
What else should we talk about?
I want to talk about the password rules are bullshit coding horror article.
Cool.
And the reason I like this is because it's something that I deal with. And I get a bit fed up with, because obviously I work with nearly 2,000 users on a daily basis, kind of thing, and passwords need to be short and convenient, and memorable, and all of that sort of thing. And telling people guidance on how to write a good password is something I would like to do with as much authenticity as possible, as in to know that I'm telling them a true thing rather than just making them run around, you know, go on every ride in the playground kind of thing, which is kind of what I feel at the moment. So everyone's familiar with passwords and the different rules that are set for passwords. So they must be 8 characters long minimum. They must include at least 2 or 3 of uppercase, lowercase, number, symbol. And they must be different from your 5 passwords. They must not match your user ID. So we have this thing when we force a password change in our school on Active Directory, the user cannot use any 2 letters that are what's the word, next to each other in their actual name.
History, yeah.
In their name. So. You can't have DNA together, for example, in your password, and that kind of thing.
Why?
And that's enforced at a policy level. So.
And how often do you get them to change their passwords?
Ideally, every 12 months. But because of that, so what happens, we have this very convoluted issues when we force people to change their passwords. They don't change them until they're locked out, unless till they change them, if you see what I mean. So you give them, doesn't matter how much warning you give them, you get loads of users that don't bother. And then when they try and change their password, they will do something in it, which is like using an old password or doing that. And the rules aren't explained to them at the point of entry. And people generally don't read instructions when they're doing this sort of thing.
Of course not, no.
And so they just try and do it. It doesn't work and it doesn't work. And then they're locked out of their system and they don't know how to get back in because they can't use their existing password and they can't choose a new one because they've tried the new one. They've tried so many different combinations of the new one and none of them work, apparently. I think it's something we just have to revisit and get to the very nitty gritty detail of, and then give a very clear message about password change. But it's a very unpopular thing to do.
Mm. When I was in Mozilla, one of the things they experimented with, which was a bit of a, you know, there's a lot of things with developers doing things because it's the latest cool thing to do. But this particular one was just not having a password. So it was a bit like, you remember when we talked about Dana Boyd and the super log off on Facebook where you actually deactivate your account?
Yeah.
It was almost, they saw that what happened was, or in a bit of research, it was either Dana Boyd or Mimi Ito or something like that, a bit of research where users were signing up for, or it was in WebMaker, that's right, WebMaker, they were doing some testing, and they saw that youth in Chicago, when they were asked to type in a password, just mashed the keyboard. And they were like, you do know you have to remember that password, right? And they're like, who remembers passwords? I just reset it every time. So
really?
Yeah, so they're like, oh, well, maybe that's a feature, not a bug. And so we don't have passwords. Every time you want to log in, you press a button, it sends you an email, you press that unique link to log in, it only works once.
It's a good idea. Just like
so it's kind of two-factor authentication without having the password.
Yeah, and if you know it's going to happen, then all you need to do is be the keeper of the keys to your email, and boom,
yeah,
you're good to go.
And you could do it off text, you could do it off whatever.
Anyway, what this article is saying is that all the rules are rubbish except for one, and the one that's not rubbish is length. So all 8-character passwords, no matter what substitution methods you use or how encrypted they are, you know, how difficult they are to, or unlike human language they are, they're all crackable, they're all brute force hackable now. And if you have the software to do it. But I think it's, I'm just trying to remember when I read this, it does say somewhere that it's the length of the password that counts. So perhaps we have one rule that passwords must not be short. A long password is much more likely to be secure than a short one, right?
Yep.
And then they actually go into, what about this 4-character password, which is 4 emojis of a tick, a horse, a battery, and a paperclip. And then the 8-character password, which is in Chinese, or this, Yeah.
Yeah, I think the point he's making there is that some, when you use emojis, although it looks like one character to you, it's actually more than one character in the system when it's stored.
Yes, so they're trying to say, so it's actually a very sensible way to write, except for the fact unless you're using to crack the password, you're using emojis. And then it's not.
Indeed. The best way of doing this is to come up with a system rather than punishing the user for not being able to remember the password and stuff. It's to come up with a system to help them to be able to do it. So I'm still considering moving away from LastPass because they're owned by LogMeIn, who aren't a nice company, and it's not open source, and da-da-da. But it's difficult because I've got a workflow and a system where it's on my phone, I've got two-factor authentication, I've got the verification app, it generates 20-character passwords. I actually used, for the first time, I used a 100-character random password.
Did you really?
Mm.
Wow.
And that was when I was doing cryptocurrency trading. Because I could, and why not? But, yeah, if you're an administrator in any organization, or you have influence on people who do password rules or whatever, read this, get them to read it, and just small changes can make people's lives easier. And the thing you've got to remember is that this is an example of when people don't like tech or don't want to use tech. This is another reason, another thing which makes their life worse when they have to use it. So, yes.
So at the bottom, there's a clarification. It says a few people have interpreted this post as all the other password rules are bullshit, except for these four I will now list. And that's not what they're saying. He says the idea is to focus on one understandable, simple, practical, works in real life in every situation rule, which is length. Users can almost enter almost anything in proper Unicode, provided it's long enough. That's the one rule to bind them all that we need to teach users. Length.
Yeah, and I've said on this podcast before, the way that I get my son to do it, he's not going to be using LastPass on his phone, all that kind of stuff yet, but preparing him for that, he's got a little notebook, which is just for writing down his passwords. He doesn't have thousands of passwords in LastPass like I do. He has less than 10 for email, Khan Academy, Duolingo and stuff. And all I've asked him to do is, when you're coming up with a password, look around you and come up with four words in the room that you're in. Like light, wallpaper, monitor, table. And just put them together and write them down. And maybe, you know, change one... make one a capital letter or whatever you want to do, but yeah, it's not very complicated, is it?
No, I think it's. I agree with you on the four word thing, and the other one that's really good if you're looking for a method is to use a song lyric and use the first letter from every song capitalizing the fifth word or whatever, and use that as a standard thing. But use different songs, and just remember the song that goes with the account, and. There are lots of little sort of good...
The number of times, though, and this is trying to get around this particular problem which I'm about to describe, which is you say to somebody, and it's usually someone close enough to you that you can actually say this to them, you say, you really shouldn't be reusing the same password on lots of different accounts. And you explain why that's the case, because, you know, if one of your accounts is compromised, then all of them are, etc. And then they try and have unique passwords, and then they haven't got a method of storing it, then they blame you for being locked out of all their accounts. And wasn't life so much easier before? And I've never been hacked, so what's the problem?
Well, I think it's quite interesting in that regard. So if you think about the threats to your password, to your security in that way, are either social, as in people who know you and are trying to access your account, or just a straight hack, which is somebody who's trying to access your account without knowing you, so they're just using software usually to crack your password, and this is possibly a case in most instances for the average Joe in the street. It's a case of just being able to outrun the. You don't have to outrun the lion. You just have to outrun the person that you're with, and the lion won't be a problem to you. And it's a bit like that, because as long as you're more secure than your average user, you're going to be okay, pretty much-ish.
Well, unless you're an activist or somebody who...
Oh, no, if you have reasons to protect yourself, it's more and more, there are more reasons, more just like back in the day when... Oh, my lack of historical knowledge here. So communism. So when everybody was under investigation for being a communist in America. And
Reds under the bed.
Yeah, that kind of era. So unless you're in a situation like that, which seems to be more and more prevalent today. Did you see the thing about aeroplanes today?
No.
All right, so the UK is in is stopping people who are flying to certain destinations taking.
Right, this is copying the US thing about if you're in one of the 8 countries, you can't take phones and laptops, yeah.
That's it. No, you can take phones, and you're allowed a phone that doesn't exceed 16-centimeter screen.
Right.
Which is an iPhone 7 Plus size, I believe. But your laptop and your tablets and whatever must be put away, which I think puts the Kindle out. I'm not sure if that counts, but you can't take your Kindle on the aeroplane anymore.
And the reason for that is because lots of people fly from those countries through Heathrow, I guess?
Well, I guess maybe.
Anyway. Therefore, it makes life easier just to copy the US rules. And from what I read and kind of pieced together, there's no new information which is leading to this. It seems like it's just... Oh, well, I can't get any judges to agree with the blanket travel ban, so I've got to do something. So, hey, let's ban electronics.
Yeah, I don't really get it. And, you know, as Wi-Fi has been made more and more available on planes, If you can afford it, then, you know, I don't really understand. It seems like bullshit, but it's
wow.
If you're planning on working on the plane, then think again, possibly.
Are you making any, have you thought about making any preparations around tech and self-defense for your trips to Thailand and India?
Yes, I have. So I've only in installing VPNs so that I can protect my location and indeed my accounts from public Wi-Fi, because I'll have to use public Wi-Fi quite a lot, I'd imagine. And I'm not taking, so I am taking a computer, but I'm just taking a very old and still fully functional Chromebook, which is a light and fast and good battery life, rather than my MacBook, just because, you know, should I lose my bag, because I'm traveling alone, should I lose my possessions in any way, then I can, I just lost a Chromebook and a passport and my money and my bank card and my, you know, but I'll be all right. I won't have lost,
You won't have lost everything.
So I've lost my phone as well, possibly, I don't know. But I won't have lost a very expensive computer, so that's
Interesting. Okay, where should we go next? How about this one? How do we, because we've been talking about various places around the world. This is my former colleagues, Bobby Richter and Laura de Reynal. They have been doing some work supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Kenya, under the guise of the, what's it, the Internet Observatory, Digital Skills Observatory. That's right. It says, The whole of the introduction is about how people coming onto the web for the first time experience it, especially if they're in a low income situation. And the example they give is in Nairobi. And it says that for a software engineer in San Francisco, the internet can be open and secure. But for a low income first time smartphone user in Nairobi, the internet is most often a small collection of apps in an unfamiliar language, limited further by high data costs. This undercuts the internet's potential as a global public resource, a resource everyone should be able to use to improve their lives and societies. And it says that, you know, a year ago, Mozilla set out to study this divide. They create the Digital Skills Observatory, la-di-da-di-da, and they're sharing their findings in a beautifully made report. And it is beautiful. And this follows up on work that's been done in Bangladesh and India and somewhere else, I can't remember.
And what have we learned? So what are they telling us?
It says, we've identified 52 digital skills for leveraging smartphones and adopting new products. I haven't really gone into any depth in this, I have to say. I've just scanned it and it does look very pretty.
So they've looked at gender and internet usage are deeply entwined. Men often have an effect on the way women use apps and services, for example, telling them to stop or controlling their usage, and they influence women's purchasing of a smartphone, usually in the form of financial support.
Mm-hmm. Gambling is a popular activity in Kenya, and many people partake with their smartphone. So, you know, context is everything.
So it's about phones actually not helping improve your financial situation and causing more financial and social problems.
And in the kind of ex-Mozilla, you know, diaspora grapevine, I did hear that they tried to get people to use a web platform and a web app and share things on there and do things more openly. And people didn't want to use Facebook. So there we go.
They just wanted to use Facebook.
They just wanted to use Facebook and what everyone else is using.
Yeah, which is usually the deal. And that's what we find in our country as well. So it says that digital skills are critical but not a panacea. Web literacy is one part of a larger equation. To become empowered digital citizens, individuals must have access, affordable data and hardware, and need. So access and need. And the need is a perceived use and value for technology.
Well, it's like that triangle from Helen Beetham and... I've forgotten the name. At Oxford, the one where it talks about, you know, access and participation and literacy and identity and how you can't just stop at giving people access and giving them skills. You have to make it feel like it's part of their life and part of their identity too, which obviously depends on context.
And in learning about internet usage, language is really, really important. So the web is largely English, and so a big challenge for people who only speak Swahili or Sheng, but though, and Sheng is a Swahili-English hybrid, but those who do speak Sheng, it increased their comfort with technology and accommodated their learning. So they learned faster because they had some English already, which is pretty obvious, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it just shows how it will erode the integrity of native languages.
There's some really interesting stuff. I'm scanning through, actually. I mean, this is quite a meaty bit of work. There's one where it talks about the HIV/AIDS scanner prank app. And it's since been removed from the Play Store, it says, but they're trying to, there are apps which are genuinely trying to help people realize whether they've got the symptoms of HIV/AIDS. But this one was like a prank app pretending to scan you and to say whether you had HIV/AIDS. And obviously, if you haven't got the kind of understanding of how these things work, then that could be quite scary, I guess.
I think that's one of the big things that the summary of this says that they found, is that people are really susceptible to internet scams, which is another reason why it can worsen their financial situations. Fraudulent apps and fraudulent news. Mind you, I think fraudulent news has had quite an impact in our country as well, one might say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's great to read the work. I'm going to sit down and read this at some point, but two very talented former colleagues, Bobby, great guy, the reason that I drink whiskey now, actually, and Laura, who joined about 6 months before I left, and just, as you can see from the report, an extremely talented photographer, interviewer, and writer, so, yeah, and speaks several languages, too. Good. Okay. There we go. What should we do next? We can wrap it up, or we can...
Let's wrap it up.
Okay, let's do that. Yeah. So let's go back to the question. I'll tell you what, let's before we go to the question, let's just talk about what we're doing this next week, and let's make the very last thing before the outro, the question that we want people to answer.
Cool.
So what are you up to this week?
This week I'm finishing off term, just had the Gale Mile competition today, which is a traditional thing, which is a 4-mile relay of four people within different year groups in a house competition in between the houses. And it was a beautiful morning here, and beautifully warm in the morning, and then windy and cold in the afternoon, sadly. So we have cross country on Thursday. No idea why two running competitions are in 1 week, but there we go. And what else am I doing? I'm going on a stag do at the weekend, and then I fly out. So really, I'm just wrapping up the nuts and bolts of this term.
Oh, so you break up on Friday, yeah?
We break up Friday, yes.
Okay. How did the lifting for charity thing go?
All right, I should mention that, of course. So a big shout out to six boys, it turned out to be in the end, who are all in my boarding house, and two of them are my tutees, and they're all in the fifth form, so that's year 11. And they lifted 230 tons of metric tons of weight lifting weights, not something I do, and within a 12-hour period was the challenge. And it's for Orbis Flying Eye Hospitals, and it's the weight of one Flying Eye Hospital, which is an Airbus. And I thought, fantastic challenge. They're never going to do it. It's going to be like their muscles are going to cripple and cramp, and it's just, it's going to be rubbish for them. I had loads of problems getting it set up. Somehow I became the teacher in charge of it, which was really, really unexpected. I just said I'd look after them, and they wanted to do it overnight. And they'd raised, in the end, they raised over £5,000, and they finished five hours early. They finished, and that was only six of them doing it when seven of them were going to.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Nice. Yeah, lots of my colleagues came along, not lots, but a few colleagues came along and supervised them for a bit during the day, which was really, really good of them. They've done really, really well. I mean, they've raised a lot of money because they have wealthy families, but nonetheless, the fact it was all of their own initiative, it was their gig, it was their charity, they chose what to do, they set it to it, and I really like the fact that it was sort of an interesting and different kind of challenge that they might
have. Definitely, that's pretty
so good. Very well done to them.
Good, good, good.
What about you up to?
So this week, so I'm in a weird period where I've got less work on, but knowing that I've got a period coming up where I've got lots of work on. So in April, I've got like two events or two things to do every week, and I'm off to Canada. So I guess what I'm trying to do is to get my thinking done, get everything sorted out, buy the things I need to buy, do my going up a mountain thing. So Friday, Saturday, I'm off to the Trossachs in Scotland to go up a mountain for 2 days. And then next week, I'll probably pick somewhere else in Scotland. And then get planning and get thinking about what I'm going to present and all that kind of stuff. And I've also got bits and pieces of client work to do, like Critical Friend stuff, got planning meetings for Canada, got a co-op day next week. My colleagues and I come together once a month to do work together. Got ongoing work with the Scottish Trade Union, bits and pieces like that. And then, yeah, I guess we're not going to actually have a podcast with you and me doing this for a few weeks because you're going to be away. So the next podcast that comes out will be like an edited thing from Anchor, and then we'll get back into the routine after that.
Sounds good. Yeah, towards the sort of back end of April. That's it. Okay.
So just remind people what the question is in terms of the care bit.
So we'll put the question on Anchor, but to start it all off. However, the question is what experience have you had that made you care about your learning, or made those whose learning you were leading and teaching or whatever, made them care about their learning? So what was the thing that made them care? And a sort of anecdotal evidence of people in the field, as it were. It doesn't have to be schools. It can be anything. It could be a lecturer. You could be working in any kind of industry where you are conscious of the idea that you were made to care about something and what it was that made you care about it.
Great. Okay, well, have a wonderful time wrapping up the end of term, and also in the two countries that you're visiting. And I'll talk to you, if not while you're there, when you get back.
You will. Likewise, you have a busy, good, busy time. Enjoy the Trossachs.
Up the Trossachs.
Take care.
Good. All right, cheers, Di.
Bye-bye.
Watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a darker bay.